Here and now, in a moment, what does this week's 400th anniversary of Jamestown have to do with U.S.-Muslim relations? But first, it's a day of behind-the-scenes meetings on Capitol Hill as Republicans and Democrats try to hammer out a compromise version of the $124 billion war spending bill, vetoed yesterday by the president because it included a timetable for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Democrats were largely united in their support of the original bill. Even modest concessions are expected to erode that solidarity, with many Democrats opposed to a proposal that the timetable for troop withdrawal be removed from a compromise bill. And at least one Republican has said, down the road, the president may be on his own. Gail Chadwick is covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from Capitol Hill, where Republican leaders spent the morning in meetings with the president. And Gail, first of all, let's start with the Republicans. Anything surprising you today?
It has really surprised me how united they are at this point around the president. Poll numbers couldn't be worse. They suffered bruising losses in the last election, mainly over the war. When we came out after the war, we were talking in terms of 40 to 60 defections. And yet, in this early stage of what happens after the veto, it's striking how Republicans are focused more on the Democrats.
To force the Democrats into a corner, perhaps?
That's right. They're looking at the number of days that we have gone without supporting troops in the field, which is a powerful issue. Now, it's interesting, you look at the poll numbers. The public doesn't like the president. The public doesn't like the war. The public wants a withdrawal from the war. But when you ask the question, should Democrats, after a veto, continue to withhold funding from the troops, those numbers drop dramatically. And I think Republicans are very encouraged by that.
Gail Chadwick
is behind them in a standoff with
Gail is speaking to us from Capitol Hill on her cell phone. We always pull her out of the action to talk to us. So, Gail, your cell phone's been acting up a bit. Oh, no, actually, it's calmed down now, so stay wherever you are.
Right.
We want to ask you, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that some Republican moderates are going to wait until September. That's the end of the fiscal year, and Congress will then be faced with another $140 billion spending request. And at that time, Republicans say they'll take a stand. The paper quotes Representative Ray LaHood of Illinois as saying that if certain goals aren't met by then, the president will, quote, be on his own.
That's what I'm hearing, too. They feel that the surge, we're only halfway through it. They want to see more results on the ground. They have a lot of confidence in General Petraeus. And where I see a consensus emerging with Republicans that could be a rift with the White House is over benchmarks. You have Republican moderates, especially in the Senate, people like Olympia Snow from Maine, who want to see some kind of accountability for the Iraqi government, not so much American forces, but for the Iraqi government.
Right.
They want to see reconciliation. They want to see a role for the Sunnis in the new government. They want to see some sort of oil sharing agreement. They want to see more security, more of an Iraqi role in security, and they most certainly want to see the Iraqi parliament not take a two-month vacation.
Well, we understand that one of the suggestions for a compromise bill is a bill that would have benchmarks for the Iraqi government, but they won't be tied to troop withdrawal. That's, of course, tough for Democrats who won their seats on a promise of troop withdrawal.
In an odd way, the Democrats have the harder political battle right now because Speaker Pelosi managed to get through with very close margins on these votes, and it's been on the promise to Democrats, especially those 80 in the Out of Iraq coalition, that some strong statement will come out of this standoff over the supplemental bill. And it looks for now as if the White House is going to dig in on dropping any kind of deadline, what they call a surrender date, and that the Republicans will support them on it.
And by the way, Gail, just in the few seconds we have, that might be what you're saying. We've heard that there's talk of two bills instead of one, the first just dealing with the immediate issue of funding, but the second to deal with policy issues.
That's right. Democrats, what's holding the Democratic caucus together is the idea that even if we have to punt on this bill, there are others coming down the line, and we will continue to ratchet up pressure. So I think both Republicans and Democrats are watching what's happening on the ground very closely. But I'm hearing that September is much more of a crunch date than May.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We pull her away from the hearings on the Hill to talk to us. And Gail, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, you might not think that our conversation today has anything to do with Iraq, but stick around. According to our next guest, America's first successful settlement, Jamestown, has a lot to do with U.S. relations with the entire Muslim world. The celebration of the 400th anniversary of Jamestown kicks into gear this week. Queen Elizabeth will tour the site of the 1607 British landing on Friday. Jamestown was the first permanent English settlement in the New World, but scholars disagree over whether it was the birthplace of the American dream or a nightmare. After all, starving settlers resorted to eating each other in the early days. And what about Jamestown's most famous founder, Captain John Smith? Was he hero or liar? Did he have a romance with the young Indian girl Pocahontas? Did she really save his life, as portrayed in the 2005 film The New World?
At the moment I was to die, she threw herself upon me.
Historian Jill Lepore revisits John Smith and Jamestown in a fascinating essay in the New Yorker magazine. She chairs the History and Literature program at Harvard University and joins us now with more. And Jill, until I read your essay, I'm not sure I knew there was cannibalism at Jamestown.
People say that to me, and I'm surprised to hear that that's so shocking. It's not something, it's not sort of particularly closeted secret of early American history.
It's just not something they bring up a lot in third grade.
That's true, that's true. I couldn't read this essay out loud to my kids. I was editing it one night while they were getting ready for bed, and they said, Mommy, what are you doing? And I said, no, you don't actually
you don't
need to know about this.
Want to know. Well, because they were starving, and we'll find out why. But as you write, a lot of Smith's claims are called into question. Would you do us a favor first and read from part of your essay where you write about his exploits after he leaves England in 1599 to find adventure? He's a mere 19 years old, so read of his exploits.
He fought the Spanish in the Netherlands, sailed to Scotland, and returned to England to live like a hermit in the woods, reading books and practicing to be a knight. After adventures in France, including a sword fight near Mont-Saint-Michel, he tried to sail from Marseille to Italy but was thrown overboard. Rescued by pirates, he sailed the Mediterranean and learned to fight at sea. In late 1600, he joined Austrian forces to fight the Turks in Slovenia and Hungary, where, for his valor in the field, he was promoted to captain. Wounded in a dismal battle in Transylvania, where 30,000 lay, some headless, armless, and legless, Smith and his fellow survivors were sold for slaves like beasts in a marketplace. He was sent to Istanbul to serve his owner's mistress, but she fell in love with him. Eventually he escaped, and after making his way through Russia and Poland and fighting in Morocco, he returned to England in the winter of 1604-05.
And then, at the age of 26, sailed to Virginia. So this was all before he was 26 years old. Is it true?
Well, this part of his story is certainly subject to a lot of inquiry, and for a long time most historians thought it was all a bunch of lies. Mostly by the late part of the 19th century, historians who bothered to pay much attention to John Smith's earlier exploits came to the conclusion that he was just a compulsive liar, that he had made much of this up. That reputation has been subject to change over the last century.
There's a wonderful anecdote you share of how, you know, even in his times, somebody did a satire of what he'd written on his own gravestone, and instead of "Here he lies, John Smith," it's "Here he lies, the liar." He was thought of as a liar back then.
Yeah, he was very much maligned during his own lifetime for being a liar. He was a braggart. I mean, even if everything he did was actually true, he wrote about it with a kind of flair, literary flair, that was from his previous age. He was an Elizabethan living in a different era. And so he came off very badly to his contemporaries. Mm. Whether he was also lying is what's really in dispute.
What about Pocahontas?
The Pocahontas thing, everyone has pretty much always understood to have been a lie. It was exposed most clearly in 1867 when Henry Adams, the later Harvard scholar, wrote an essay in which he showed how it was not possible that Pocahontas actually saved John Smith's life in the way that he said. As we understand it, Smith never wrote about this alleged rescue by Pocahontas during the early years when he was actually in Virginia or soon after he returned. It wasn't until years and years later, after Pocahontas had visited the Queen of England and been received as a foreign dignitary with all the aplomb in the court, that Smith somehow wanted to kind of get a piece of that story and rewrote his own history to include this dramatic rescue.
And also alluding to this romance, but as it turns out, Pocahontas, who was the daughter of the powerful tribal leader, did actually marry a colonist, just not John Smith.
And Smith, to be fair, never suggested there was anything romantic between himself and Pocahontas. That was an invention of the 19th century.
Let's talk about Jamestown. You write that celebrating Jamestown's founding in 1607 as America's birthday is at first absurd. You asked the question, you know, what are we celebrating here? Why did it go so poorly? Remind us, who was there, and why was it, as an historian called it, a fiasco?
Well, the English were relative latecomers to the New World. In fact, it was a great frustration to the English crown that the Spanish crown was enriching itself and had been for centuries before the English managed to get around to founding a colony in the New World.
Ponce de Leon, the Florida.
There are all these Spanish treasure fleets crossing the Atlantic. Yeah. English pirates are trying to get a little bit of that money. But England is really very far behind politically and economically in this period. And there's a great reluctance to go to the New World, in fact. It's Queen Elizabeth who comes to think that really the right thing to do is for England to reach for an empire. And the English first head to start a new world venture in 1584 in Roanoke, which is off the coast of what is now North Carolina. But even then, remember that, you know, Columbus's voyage was 1492. The first Spanish settlement is 1502. So Jamestown is a century after the fact. The Spanish have a vast empire in the New World. The Portuguese are there. The Dutch are there.
Crowded.
The French are there.
The Native
American
Indians.
The English pretty much take what's left.
Yeah.
The land that they take is considered the least desirable.
You mentioned Roanoke. I just want to mention in passing that remains a huge mystery, what happened to the 100 settlers, men, women, and children who were there.
Yeah, Roanoke fails pretty much because England doesn't really have an idea that it's going to go start a colony where people will permanently settle. What they really want is to start military outposts that can be used as resupply bases for English ships that are trying to attack the Spanish treasure fleets. So Roanoke doesn't have enough support, and the English who are behind that venture don't understand just how much it would take to get a colony started, and what the situation with the native inhabitants will really be.
And then further in Jamestown, a poor site, lousy plan, wrong kind of settlers. What do you mean by that?
Well, John Smith was quite emphatic on this point, that the Virginia Company, which is this joint stock company, you know, a corporation, we would call it, that funds the venture to Jamestown, decides to send second and third sons of noblemen, very fancy aristocratic gentlemen in England who are not used to taking care of themselves, don't even dress themselves in the morning, and they're supposed to go and found this colony, and they bring their footmen, their valets, and then there are a few soldiers and a couple of guys who are carpenters. But they get there, or John Smith would say, they get there and no one's willing to work. Right. I mean, these gentlemen want to be served, and maybe what they'll do is take a little adventure out into the woods and see if they can find gold. And John Smith would say, there couldn't be a worse group of settlers if you were trying to found a new settlement.
Well, in fact, many of the gentlemen, you write, spent their time bowling in the streets. Jill Lepore chairs the History and Literature Program at Harvard University. We're talking about this month's 400th anniversary of Jamestown, which she wrote about in a recent New Yorker magazine article. When we come back, we mentioned earlier John Smith, the Crusader. He made his name killing Turks in battle before coming to Jamestown. We'll hear more about that. But also, later today, we're reminded that we'll have the political struggle in modern-day Turkey for you. Nearly a million people recently protested there, fearing that their current prime minister has designs to make their secular country into an Islamist state. So we'll hear more about that later. Back after a quick break with Jill Lepore, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from historian Jill Lepore talking about Jamestown as it celebrates its 400th anniversary, a story she says has echoes today in Iraq, as we're going to hear. Her article about Jamestown appeared in a recent issue of The New Yorker. Before the break, we were talking about the first wave of English settlers that landed in 1607 and started Jamestown. They were not hard workers. Hunger and disease nearly wiped them out. Some even resorted to cannibalism. But later, new immigrants arrived. They were willing to work. And when they learned how to grow tobacco, Jamestown really took hold, became the first American boomtown.
It does last, and it grows. And although the mortality rates are incredibly high, the English continue to be able to convince people to go settle. I mean, they're really kind of passing out handbills in taverns, and it's not so great being in England either. So a lot of indigent Britons are willing to go and just see what happens. So it's the constant arrival of new immigrants that makes Jamestown survive. And those immigrants, most of them are not gentlemen, you know, after the first kind of hapless years, and they do work hard. And Smith figures out that the best way for the settlers to survive is to disperse the settlement. Not everybody should be right next to this fort because the water's really bad and it's making people sick. So there are lessons learned and there's success and there's the constant resupply of new immigrants who do work hard.
Now we should say, you quote people who say that Jamestown really wasn't this bad, that there were a bunch of whiners, and that that makes it sound worse than it was.
The reason I wrote this essay was, it used to be when I would teach the story of Jamestown to my students, my undergraduate students or my graduate students, it would always be a great debate because you could read different essays by different historians. And everyone was asking this really interesting question. Why did it go so badly? I mean, why are they eating each other? I mean, this is the birth of America. How does this happen? And you'd read these different explanations. It's like a great mystery story. Well, was this, you know, was it salt poisoning? Did the grain go bad? Was it the Indians? You know, were there too many gentlemen? Was it the weather was worse than they thought? I mean, did they just bring not enough clothes? What could possibly explain this complete fiasco? And it's a great debate, and it's a great way for students, or I always found it to be a great way for students to see that you have to look to the evidence and there are different explanations, and maybe there's not enough evidence to prove any of them. So I was startled to see when I picked up the books that are coming out this year, many of them simply produced in honor of the anniversary, that actually don't ask that question and instead turn that question upside down and ask, how did things manage to go so well? In the sense that... it does survive. I mean, unlike Roanoke and unlike some later English ventures that do fail as well, Jamestown does survive, and it does go on to be a phenomenal success. There's a huge boom once the colonists figure out to plant tobacco, and that they can, then once the market for tobacco grows in Europe, economically, the place just thrives, and so more and more settlers come. But I still think it's the wrong question, and it's a question that serves contemporary political interests rather than the needs of historical evidence.
Mm. Well, and you know, I have to say, in reading your essay, I was thinking, wow, here they're trying to forge this new, you know, democracy, whatever you know, however you want to call it, and they end up cannibalizing each other. I read this with a glance over to Iraq, for instance, and you know, said to myself, well, it's a reminder, it's not that easy. To launch a new country, to get a new country off the ground.
Yeah, I find it very hard to write anything these days that isn't somehow one way or another about Iraq. So troubled by it on a daily basis. I mean, it's easy to overread those parallels, but clearly what happens in Jamestown is they don't know what to expect. They are phenomenally unprepared, and it leads to an extraordinary tragedy.
Hmm. You know, since we have mentioned Iraq, I just want to comment on a few paragraphs that just sort of leap off the page, which is the early colonists' connection to Islam. And that many of these, you know, they'd call themselves adventurers, or, you know, warriors, whatever they were, who ended up being the founding fathers of Jamestown, had fought in wars in Turkey, had been in the Middle East, had an opinion of Islam. Tell us more about that.
Well, John Smith's whole travels before he ends up traveling to Virginia in 1606 are about fighting religious wars in Europe. And he starts out fighting other Christians in sort of Protestant versus Catholic wars, and he tires of it and says, I don't want to kill any Christians. I'd like to go kill some Muslims.
Does he really say that?
Yeah, he does say that. I'm tired of killing Christians. And, you know, that's why his shield depicts three severed heads of Turkish champions that he kills in these duels. He's quite proud of having killed so many Turks.
And he had been enslaved to Muslims.
He was also enslaved by Turks. And one of the things I think is a real missed opportunity in this commemoration of Jamestown this year is we've made so much effort toward thinking about how Jamestown is the birth of who we are now. Instead of understanding what gave birth to Jamestown, we're so interested in moving from the past to the present that moving within the past is an impulse that we don't necessarily have as Americans. We're very present-minded. And one of the greatest things about some of the best research into Jamestown is understanding the world that made Jamestown, not the world that Jamestown made.
Right. And, you know, the part of the world that made it, as you said, was this awareness of Muslims, wars with Muslims. And you write, the idea that coming to the new America to find gold was in part to find gold, to find a way to fund a war against Muslims.
That's why England wants to get the Spanish treasure fleets and wants to tap into those resources in the New World to make it possible to be more successful fighting Muslims in the Old World.
And here we still are, fighting fundamental, you know, right, as the administration would say, fundamentalist,
right,
Muslims.
Right, right. I think that one thing to remember and maybe is worth considering, we may have forgotten that, but I don't think the Islamic world has forgotten that. I think the sense of a long past, a long arc of a past involving conflict between Christians and Muslims is much more actively present in the minds of many people in the Islamic world than it is in people in the West. We have a particular kind of historical amnesia in this country, and it is about forgetting where we came from, because it is about fetishizing the revolutionary moment and fetishizing the founders, and it is about forgetting what came before. It's about understanding ourselves as a whole new thing, a world begun anew, instead of understanding the world that made us. I mean, the whole philosophy behind the commemoration of Jamestown is there is a beginning and this is it. It's not a beginning, it's a middle, right? There was a lot of history before 1607, and the world that Americans live in now is part of that history, and we are therefore part of that history. I think it's a disservice to how we understand our place in the world to have the kind of historical amnesia. We're hobbled by the historical amnesia that Americans have. Yeah. Why should it be so surprising that the English men and women who came to Virginia had a particular view of the Muslim world and that it operated very deeply in how they understood their own actions?
Because that was the context in which they lived.
That's how they understood it. Why have we forgotten that?
Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jill Lepore chairs the History and Literature Program at Harvard University. For more on the 400th anniversary of Jamestown, go to our website, here-now.org. Still ahead today, Bob of Bob and Ray, Here and Now.
Support for
Here and Now. The Prime Minister of Turkey has called for early parliamentary elections in the hopes of calming the tensions over his nominee for president. Nearly 1 million people protested this week, concerned that Prime Minister Recep Erdogan's choice for president would turn Turkey into an Islamic state. Most of the people in Turkey are Muslim, many are moderate, and the government is secular. The military has staged 4 coups since 1960, citing fears that the country was losing its democracy to religious factions, and the military warned it would take action again to keep the government secular. Dr. Stephen Cook is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Ruling But Not Governing: The Military and Political Development in Egypt, Algeria, and Turkey. He's on a trip to Saudi Arabia and joins us from there. Dr. Cook, this crisis started when Prime Minister Erdogan tapped his foreign minister, Abdullah Gül, to be president. Why do the protesters believe that Gül has a hidden agenda to move Turkey towards an Islamic state?
Well, Gül and Prime Minister Erdogan represent a party called the Justice and Development Party that is the most recent successor to a series of Islamist-oriented political parties. So there is suspicion that there is another agenda at work behind the scenes among these two men. Fueling that suspicion, of course, is the fact that both the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister's wives wear the Islamic headscarf, the hijab.
That has seemed to become, as some would say, an alarming symbol to many, which is surprising to many in the States who thought that, you know, many women wore these scarves, but it really is resonating in Turkey.
Well, you have to understand that in the context of Turkish politics, wearing the hijab to many secularists is a sign of Islamic radicalism. Turkish secularism is much different from the secularism of the United States, where anybody can wear a headscarf, a cross, a yarmulke, anywhere. But in Turkey, that's not the case. The system is more like the French system of laicisme, in which the government tries to ensure that there's no public expression of religion. At least in politics, there's no expression of religion.
Well, when Prime Minister Erdogan gained power, there were also concerns that he had an Islamic agenda. Did that turn out to be true?
In fact, this government has done more to push Turkey along into the direction of a more liberal and open democratic polity than any other previous government in the history of Turkey. Now, some would suggest that he did have an Islamist agenda, but he was blocked by the combined power of the judiciary, the president, who was an arch-secularist, and the military establishment.
Well, in fact, he did try to, we understand, ban adultery, forbid the sale of alcohol in city-run cafes,
right.
But as you said, he was blocked. And that brings us to the concern that he, in extending perhaps his power to the presidency, would more solidify his stand. Interestingly, Erdogan's ruling party says it wants to move towards a U.S.-style presidency with an executive. Now, on its face, that might look more like our democratic form of government, but we understand that's worrisome to many secular Turks because it gives the president more power.
Well, that's precisely the case. I think that the military has taken a move to undermine the ability of the Justice and Development Party to place one of their own in the presidency, fearing that any kind of amendment to the Constitution that would have an Islamist agenda would not be vetoed, but would be happily accepted. President Sezer, the current president, has vetoed any legislation that has even hinted at a change to Turkey's secular political system.
Some are saying that all of this is a gamble for Erdogan. Would that necessarily be in his party's favor, a popular vote?
Well, he does remain the most popular politician in Turkey. And in fact, if you go by historical precedent, every time the military has stepped in this effort to kind of engineer the political system, it has faced a popular backlash. In Turkish politics, the people generally have, in time, voted against their wishes.
Well, in fact, the military has been told by the European Union to stand down in this case, to do nothing.
Well, you know, this is a little too little from the European Union. The EU has been an anchor of Turkish reform. However, as European leaders have sent the signal that Turkey isn't welcome in the European Union because it's a Muslim country, popular support in Turkey for the EU project has diminished considerably. That's given the military more room to maneuver in the political system, and the result is the political crisis that we're observing right now.
By the way, how much has this hurt Turkey's attempt to join the European Union?
Oh, I think this has set back Turkey's efforts to join the European Union by at least a decade.
Really?
This is something that the European Union has been consistently alert to, is the role of the military in politics. Four times in the last 40 years, the military has stepped in to bring down governments that it did not approve of.
Even if, you know, historians would also say that those were attempts to keep the government secular.
Well, I think that that's a particular interpretation of the situation. I think that what the military has done has been inherently anti-democratic. And in fact, when you look at it and you look at the reforms that the Justice and Development Party, this party with Islamist roots, that have undertaken since they came to power in 2003, they have done more to form Turkey's political system so that it conforms more closely to a liberal democratic polity. This certainly sets it back.
Turkey has long been a traditional ally of the U.S. The U.S. has a base there. But since the invasion of Iraq, we know the popular support for the U.S. has waned. We remember doing a story here last year on a film called Valley of the Wolves, Iraq.
That's correct. Right.
It stars Gary Busey. It portrays American soldiers in Iraq as bloodthirsty warmongers. And what was one of the most successful films ever released in Turkey. Has that anti-American feeling pushed Turkish people closer to fundamentalism?
Well, no, not at all. In fact, what you see in Turkey is more nationalism rather than fundamentalism. And, you know, Turks have a right to be unhappy with the situation in Iraq. The invasion of Iraq has negatively affected Turkish national security. It has coincided with a return of terrorism on the part of the Kurdistan Workers Party, known more commonly by its acronym PKK, which on a daily basis kills two or three Turkish soldiers, has targeted Turkish civilians in vacation areas, has also given impetus and encouragement to Kurdish nationalism, which many, many Turks see as a threat to the integrity of their country. So from the Turkish perspective, what the United States done in Iraq has negatively affected their own personal and national security. And so it's really no surprise to me that the United States is not as popular as it once was. What you've seen in Turkey over the course of the last year or so has been a shift towards a more nationalism as they've gotten into trouble with the European Union, as the relations with the United States has deteriorated. Hardly the case that more and more Turks are moving towards this kind of Islamic radicalism. In fact, poll after poll after poll demonstrates that only 10% or less of the Turkish public actually want to live in an Islamic state that is ruled by Islamic law.
And the protests we've been seeing in the past few weeks would seem to underscore that.
Without a doubt.
Dr. Stephen Cook, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking to us from Saudi Arabia, where he's visiting, about the political crisis in Turkey. Dr. Cook, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And a quick note about tomorrow. West Side Story's Cheetah Rivera.
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another. One of your own kind. Stick to your own kind.
She was also the Spider Woman. She was Velma in Chicago. We're so excited this Broadway legend will be talking to us. That's tomorrow. Still to come today, radio's Bob Elliott. You're listening to Here and Now.
One of your own kind. Stick to your own kind. A boy who kills cannot love. A boy who kills has no heart. And he's the boy who gets your love and gets your heart.
Grammar is one of those things students love to hate, and Gary Spina hated it as well. He was going to grow up to be a mountain man. No point in learning grammar until he discovered that, as he puts it, a man needs grammar as much as he needs the love and warmth of the right woman on a cold, wintry night. In other words, a lot. Gary Spina now teaches high school English, and to help his students see the point of gerunds and adjectives and intransitive verbs, he's written The Mountain Man's Field Guide to Grammar, a fearless adventure in grammar, style, and usage. And he joins us now from Lake Hiawatha, New Jersey. So, of course, I'm wondering, was there anything grammatically incorrect in my introduction?
Let's preface this conversation by saying that I'm always warned by my own kids, Dad, if you're being interviewed, be careful with your pronouns. So it's fine. If you spoke perfect grammar, or if I spoke perfect grammar, our conversation would be stilted.
Awfully boring. And as you say, a noun is a noun and a verbal is a verbal. What's a verbal?
Well, a verbal can take on many different... You're going to really question me now. You're going to put me on the spot, huh?
Well, I do know that the gerund can be a verbal.
And a participle and...
A verbal is like a tamed cougar or a domesticated mountain man. How so?
You can't trust either one of them. You have to be careful around them. They're not always what they seem to be.
A verbal is a word formed from a verb but serving as another part of speech. Tell us more.
Well, if you say the word swim, to swim, is a verb. But mm-hmm. Swimming, once you put the ing on it, it becomes a noun. That's called a gerund. Why is that important that you know what a gerund is, what a verbal is? When you say something like, Dirty Doris objected to his spitting tobacco, once you know that spitting with the ing is a gerund, then you know that you need the possessive. You need to say, Dirty Doris objected to his spitting.
What I love about the book is the examples you give of these things. Playing gleefully before coming to his senses, Big Jake was stuffing beans up Iron Skillet's nose while she slept. I'm not concentrating as much on the participle there as I am on the stories that you tell while you describe the grammar. Where do they come from?
Well, I was born in New Jersey back in a time when New Jersey had a lot of woods and swamp. And my brother and I used to go out in the swamps and get lost, and the tide would go out, and we'd be stuck out there. And, you know, we just had little adventures like that.
Is there a connection between that kind of clean, natural life and clear thinking and understanding of words?
Well, there is, in a sense, that when I was a kid, I ended up in a children's home. I was 6 years old.
Huh.
We had bars on the windows and locked doors, and you had to stand in line to eat your food. And if you didn't eat your bread, you got smacked in the back of the head, eat your bread. And I felt like I was in jail. When months later I got back to my regular school, my first grade teacher read a story to us called The Ransom of Red Chief by O. Henry. And she finished the story and said, by the way, you know, O. Henry wrote this story from a jail cell. And immediately felt like I'd just gotten out of jail. I said, wow, a writer can write from anywhere. If you're a writer, nobody can hold you back. If you're a writer, you could do anything you want. And I knew then, at 6 years old, I was going to write.
Well, and you were also going to have a life of adventure. Merchant seaman, police officer, private eye, journalist, traveling salesman, almost a rodeo cowboy. And do I understand that although you're a high school English teacher now, the book has done just well enough that you are actually going to hang it all up and go to the mountains?
I'm leaving the teaching profession after this year, and I'm going to go to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia.
And do what?
Well, I'm at a point where I've got so much I want to write for my kids and grandkids, and I want them to understand how things were when I was growing up. The world is so much different now. I would not want to be a young person growing up today. It's a tough world.
Well, but, you know, the thing is, in taking off for the mountains, which was your dream, you're going to the mountains is going to be the classroom's loss.
Oh, you are so sweet to say that. But I've got number 10 grandchild on the way. I've got 5 grown kids. I'll always be around kids.
Well, that's Gary Spina. He's author of The Mountain Man's Guide to Grammar, a fearless adventure in grammar, style, and usage. Thank
Robin,
you.
Robin, thank you.
Well, still ahead, he put the Bob in Bob and Ray, Bob Elliott, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. If you did a family tree of droll comics, it would wend its way back through David Letterman and Bob Newhart, back through Carson, to Bob and Ray. The comedy duo Bob and Ray was born on WHDH Radio here in Boston in 1946. Bob Elliott was the DJ, Ray Goulding the newscaster, and when the Red Sox games were delayed by rain, they began a banter that turned into a national act, the two playing a cast of over 100 characters, including the hapless journalist Wally Ballou.
This is radio's highly regarded Wally Ballou, winner of 16 Diction Awards,
or Mary Magoon, with her recipe for frozen ginger ale salad and decorating advice.
I was rather disappointed in the somber decor of your studio today, and I wondered what the reason was, why you changed from such...
Bob and Ray begat many modern-day funny men. Letterman, Leno, Kurt Vonnegut were all fans. CNN's Keith Olbermann pays homage by stealing one of Bob and Ray's characters. And Bob Elliott literally begat Chris Elliott. Chris is his son. Ray Goulding died in 1990. Bob Elliott lives in Maine. Both are in the Radio and Television Hall of Fame. And Bob is about to be inducted into the New England version. So we thought we'd call and congratulate him. Hello there.
Hi, Robin. Thank you very much.
Nice to speak with you. There's that
quite
voice.
An honor.
You know, your voice hasn't changed. Do people tell you that?
Yeah, they do. And I find it hard to believe. I get people that recognize me by voice, and
they do.
I usually slip into Wally Ballou before they talk very long.
Can you do a little? Where's Wally now?
Wally Ballou is right here next to Bob.
See, he never got his mic on in time, or the engineer didn't, to hear the wall part. It always came out Lee Ballou.
He made loyal fans out of a lot of engineers across the country.
How'd you do him? A sort of a nasally thing?
Yeah, kind of adenoidal, which I am to an extent, I guess, but he was based on somebody that worked at the station when all the characters were prototypes of people who were on the air at that time.
We want to listen to a little more from Wally Ballou. He's trying to broadcast a 4th of July parade.
Yeah, I remember that. Happened more than once.
Every time he's ping-ponging between himself and who's his colleague?
Artie Skirbehorn.
Right. Oh, and each time music. It goes back and forth, they've just missed voice, the music. Let's listen.
Up at this end, Wally, we have a group of children parading by now, and there's, yes, a band in back of them. So, engineer, let's swing down. And same thing seems to have happened here, Wally. Back to your vantage point.
Better luck next time, Artie Skirbehorn. Oh, wait a minute. There is a band now, and I think if we swing our parabolic microphone down, we'll catch it. A little bit.
A Bob and Ray skit as the hapless Wally Ballou tries to broadcast the 4th of July parade just as the band ends every time.
He was hapless in most everything he undertook.
That's right. Bob Elliott, were you aware that MSNBC's Keith Olbermann had copied your character, the worst person in the world?
Yes, I am, and I wrote Keith a thank you a couple of years ago. Our last series on WOR in New York in the 70s, I guess it was, Keith used to come up. His father used to bring him into the studio. He was, I don't know, early teens, I think.
Really?
And he would sit in and study what we did, and he was a fan even back then.
Well, now, he does do, as we said, the worst person in the world character. Yep. He's also written a book of the same title.
Right.
Now, who was you, when you created the character, who was that supposed to be?
Well, we didn't let on for a long time. It was a character that would pop in and out of Mary Backstage, the soap opera we did.
Right, she was the noble wife, Mary Backstage.
And it happened after our Broadway show had received rave reviews from everybody except John Simon. So we finally got bold enough to say, well, yeah, to us the worst person in the world was John Simon because he really reamed us.
He was the New York Magazine theater reviewer.
He was at that time, and we liked the fashion newspaper. What is that?
Vogue?
Women's
or
Wear Daily.
Oh, Women's Wear Daily.
We liked their review. They reviewed our suits.
What was the primary purpose? I mean, Keith also writes in his book about acknowledging you and your impact on him. It was funny, but he also, for instance, commends your spoof of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s.
Yeah, it was our comment on the whole thing. We'd go next door to a bar at noontime and watch the proceedings and then transpose everything that happened into the soap episode the next morning. Ray did an absolute dead-on McCarthy, and we just followed the pattern of their questions and answers and applied it to Mary backstage.
I love how you both, and Ray perhaps a little more, if I'm right here, would have female characters, but not really go that far out of your way to do female voices.
Never in drag. Ray did the main female voice was Mary Magoon, as you mentioned, right. And then he also did Mary backstage.
Well, I want to listen to a scene in which he's playing someone's mother.
Okay.
And your character comes in the room. She summoned her son in the room. And I can't, lost to my memory is the skit, but I want you to listen to the humor. Because I don't want to ask you about that.
Come in and close the door, Rodney. I have something important to discuss with you.
I'd like to oblige, Mother, but there's no door in this room to close. If you'll notice, it's merely an archway of the English Tudor style with some scroll work above.
Oh, never mind. I know what it looks like. Just sit down.
Now, when I listened to that scene, Bob Elliott, all I could think of was the scene from Airplane where one character says to the other, "You better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital." "A hospital," says the stewardess. "What is it?" "It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now." I mean, I heard echoes of Bob and Ray in that Airplane scene. And when I hear that scene, we just heard it. Felt it echoed it. Do you hear echoes of your work and other work?
I do, yeah. But I think anybody who's been in it as long as we were will say the same thing.
Do you think that, you know, as we listen to some of these skits unfold, I mean, it takes time to let it unfold.
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, there's not that attention span for that anymore?
Yeah, I think probably. We did. We had time to kill.
You only started because you were doing rain delay fill.
Yes, and that was one big delay. We used to use a desk drawer as a sound effect for a door opening, and if things got dull, we'd open pull the drawer out, and the door would open, and somebody would come in. I don't know, Robin. We just looked at everything around us, and we seemed to have the same outlook on everything that we saw. It was great chemistry between us.
Yeah. We mentioned, of course, that Ray Goulding passed away in 90.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that was? Because it seemed instant, and I'm sure you miss it.
Oh, I do, greatly. I did a few things after he passed away, and it wasn't really fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, working that closely with someone for so long, it's a marriage, you know.
What would you say was that chemical ingredient?
I don't know. I think it's a magical thing. The kibitzing got longer and longer each day until we were really doing a show. And
we've been saying here it was sort of in the car talk of its day without cars.
Yeah. All right.
Well, Bob Elliott, we so appreciate your time. We so appreciate the, decades of work.
I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
It's a ferocious carnivora found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores.
Where do they come from?
Some more classic Bob and Ray. And for more on this weekend's celebration of classic radio here in the New England area, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Is found on the island of Komodo.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.